So this is a report on joint work with Kai Behrend. Greg Vino and Ping Xu. So what we do is we construct these string operations of Chess and Sullivan for the loop for the homology of the loop stack of certain types of topological stacks. So as a consequence, we obtain equivariant versions of the string topology when there is a group action by compact Lie group. So there are some keywords that appear in the title of my talk, so let me make a list of those keywords. So the first one is Fulton-McPherson bivariant theories. The second one is topological stacks. And the third one is string topology. So I have divided my talk into four parts. In the first three parts, I explain what these things mean. So the first part is this, the second part is this, and the third part is this. These are completely independent. So these are three independent topics. And then in the fourth part, I put them all together. So what I will do in the fourth part is I will apply Fulton-McPherson bivariant theories to topological stacks to produce string topology operations for the loop stacks of topological stacks. So the fourth part will be string topology for topological stacks. Okay, let me start with Fulton-McPherson bivariant theories. Okay, so the setup is as follows. We have a category. So we have a category which has finite products with finite, and it carries certain extra structure plus extra structure. So the extra structure consists of a family of commutative triangles which are called confined triangle. So we are given this family. We are also given a family of commutative squares. And there are some axioms to be satisfied by these families, but I don't want to get into those axioms. The second part of a structure is we have bivariant groups associated to morphisms in this category. So let me call this C. So bivariant groups for morphisms in C. So that means for every morphism F, we have a Z-graded abelian group associated to F. Which is called the bivariant group of F. And finally, these bivariant groups are supposed to carry some extra structure. So So basically, there are three operations on these bivariant groups. One of them is called confined push forward. So push forward for confined triangles. So every time you have a triangle like this, you can take a bivariant class for this map and push it forward to a bivariant class for that map. Okay? We have pullbacks for independent squares. So anytime you have a bivariant class for this guy, you can pull it back to a bivariant class for that guy. I meant independent. So independent squares are supposed to be commutative. Independent squares. Okay. And the last piece of the structure is a product for these bivariant groups. So anytime you have two morphisms that can be composed, you have a product for the corresponding bivariant groups. So if you have HI of F and HJ of G, then you can multiply them and you find the class in HI plus J of G composed with F. And then there are some axioms to be satisfied. I don't want to get into these axioms. So this is what goes into a Fulton-McPherson bivariant theory. So what are these things good for? Let me just try to give you some vague ideas what these bivariant groups mean. So what these guys do for us is they somehow combine a homology theory and the cohomology theory. Let me explain what that means by a simple example. So for example, there is a bivariant theory on the category of nice topological spaces. So these are nice topological spaces such that if you look at the bivariant groups for the identity maps, so let me call the bivariant theory H, then H star of the identity map is the singular cohomology and if you look at let me call this I and this will be I. If you look at H minus I of X mapping to a point, that will be singular homology. And these bivariant groups somehow interpolate between these guys. I just want to make a remark that none of these guys uniquely determines the other one. So there are some variations on these constructions. So for example, you can take one of these bivariant theories and change it a little bit so that the homology theory stays the same and the cohomology theory changes, or you can fix the cohomology theory and change the homology theory. So the idea is that you can play with the supports and produce supported versions of bivariant theories, and that way you have some flexibility on these theories. So let me just give you one more example. how you can do this. So there is another bivariant theory on the category of topological spaces, such that the cohomology groups are the same, but the homology groups are the Borel-Moore homology. And the final remark is that you can actually start with any ring spectrum and out of that produce a bivariant theory. And you can also, as I said, you can also play with the supports of that bivariant theory. So actually for a given ring spectrum, so the next example if you choose a ring spectrum plus a notion of support, whatever that means, out of this you can produce the bivariant theory. Okay. So the reason we are interested in these bivariant theories is these operations that go into the definition of a bivariant theory allows you to recover many well-known constructions in algebraic topology. So let me make a list of a few of them that I will be using today. So we can use bivariant theories to produce certain operations in algebraic topology. The ones I'm interested in are various kinds of products, for example, cup product or cap product, Giesing maps. You can construct Giesing maps using bivariant theories, and so on. I will explain a little bit more how these things can be done. Yes. Okay, so in this case, it will be all commutative triangles. In this case, this top map has to be proper. And the independent squares in both cases are just Cartesian squares. Okay. No. So here, nice means it can be realized as a closed subspace of some Rn. Closed subspace of some. So they are locally compact, yeah. But you need more than that. Okay, so let me explain how we can recover products from these axioms. So let's look at cup product. So what is a cup product? The cup product goes from hi of x tensor hj of x into hi plus j of x. Okay. Well, what is this? This is just hi of the identity map. Should have more space. This is hj of the identity map, and this is hi plus j of the identity map. So I can use this product right there to recover cup product. Now let's see how we can construct cap products. So cap product goes from h I of x tensor h lower j of x into h j minus I of x. Well, this is h I of the identity map. This is h minus j of the constant map. So if I multiply them, I find h I minus j of the constant map. This is equal to this. This is equal to that, and this is equal to this. And you can play the same game with other types of products. So you can do exterior products or slant products and everything. Okay, so that's how you can do products. Let me show you how you can do GC maps. So to construct GC maps, we start with a fixed bivariant class. So assume we are given a bivariant class for our map F. Using this, I will construct GC maps for the homology. So these are pullbacks on homology, which go from homology of Y into homology of X. So more precisely, I will have a pullback from H I, oh no, this is H I of Y into H, I'm sorry, this should be H J of Y into H J minus I X. So this is the Giesen map on homology. There is also a push forward on cohomology. It goes from hj of y into hj plus I of x. The construction is pretty easy. So here you take an element A, you map it to theta times A. So again, I'm using this part. This one is a little more interesting. It takes B, it maps it to B times theta, but this B times theta is sitting in the wrong bivariant group. So to put it in the correct place, you have to take the confined push forward. For this to make sense, we need to make an assumption. So we need to assume we need this to be confined. So the homology Giesen maps are always defined. The cohomology Giesen maps are defined if this condition is satisfied. Okay, just one last remark before I finish this part of my talk. There are many other examples of bivariant theories. Actually, the more interesting examples are the ones coming from algebraic geometry. And actually, that was the motivation for Fulton and McPherson to develop these theories. So it's a bit unfortunate that these are not so popular among topologists. I think they're very interesting stuff. So okay, so now let me go to the second part of my talk. So here I want to say a few words about topological stacks and just mention the facts that I will need for the next part, I mean for the last part. Okay, so what is a topological stack? So, I will write pre-topological stack, but I will read topological stack. The reason for this is, in my paper, I use this stupid terminology of pre-topological stack, but I decided to change it. So in the new version, you won't see this. So a topological stack is a stack over the category of topological spaces. Actually, this top is different from that top. This top means all compactly generated weakly Hausdorff topological spaces. So a topological stack is a stack over top that is of the form, yes, again, yes.
X and Y are reversed.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. It's a push forward for cohomology and pull back for homology. Okay, any other misprints? Yeah, my students always complain about my misprints in the course evaluations. Okay, so a topological stack is a stack of this form where this is a topological group point. Okay. I'm glad I don't have to define what a stack is. Usually every time I give this talk, people want me to define what a stack is, and I refuse. What's that?
No conditions on
SMT? No, no conditions. Okay, so I'll keep the parentheses here just in case. Okay, so there is another type of topological stacks that are more interesting, and those are the ones that are probably, they deserve to be called topological stacks, but I give them even more credit. I call them Hurwitz topological stacks. So Hurwitz topological stack is the one for which you can choose this groupoid so that the source and target maps, actually, it's enough to look at only one of them, so that S and T are local Hurwitz vibrations. What does this mean?
Just to say,
yes.
So I'm assuming we know what an equivalent for topological group rate is. And let me just check that that is. Is it a topological group rate?
No, it's more than that. Actually, so if you know what this is, so an equivalence of topological groupoids means the corresponding quotient stacks are equivalent.
No.
Or equivalency, there is a Morita equivalent. So there is, you can make a diagram like this. So it means you can find a third topological groupoid, a Morita equivalence from the third one to the first one, and the Morita equivalence from... it means a map of... just a strict map of topological groupoids, which has some properties. Should I write that down? It's an equivalence of underlying groupoids. Yes, yes. I mean, there is a little bit more conditions. What's that? It is a stack-wise equivalence, and there is some more conditions. So, okay, I have to write this down. What's that?
You could erase.
I'm going to erase the whole thing. So, this is just a distraction. So a Morita equivalence means you have a map of topological groupoids, which is an equivalence in the sense you mentioned, and this map is an epimorphism. What does that mean? It means it admits local sections. Okay? So if we can find a diagram like this, I say this guy and this guy are equivalent. If you are interested in differentiable stacks, your definition will be slightly different. You will require that this is a submersion. So depending on what category you work with, you have to use the correct notion of epimorphism. Okay, so I have to tell you what a local Hurwitz vibration is. So a local Hurwitz vibration means the following. So we say a map of topological spaces is a local Hurwitz vibration if it has this property that anytime you pick a point, you can find a neighborhood, an open neighborhood of the point upstairs and the image downstairs, so that when you look at the restriction map, it's a Hurwitz vibration. So for example, every submersion is a Hurwitz vibration, is a local Hurwitz vibration. Once you put this condition on these maps, homotopy theory for stacks become very well behaved. But even without this condition, there is a lot of things you can do with these guys. So let me tell you what you can do with pre-topological stacks and what more you can do with Hurwitz topological stacks. So if you have a pre-topological stack, you can do quite a bit of algebraic topology. You can define homotopy groups. And homotopy groups, I mean in a canonical sense. So like if you fix a base point, you can define a canonical homotopy group pi n of x based at x. So we have these nice homotopy groups. We can define generalized cohomology groups. So we can do, I don't know, K-theory, homology, singular homology, whatever. What else we can do? We can define what a vibration is. For example, we can talk about fiber homotopy exact sequences. So we can use these to compute homotopy groups. We can compute homology and cohomology using Lorentz spectral sequence and so on. And finally, and this is very important for us, we can talk about mapping stacks. So the theorem that is relevant to part four is the following. Assume you are given a pre-topological stack Y, which is a quotient with Y0 and Y1 compact Hausdorff. And assume X is an arbitrary pre-topological stack. Then you can look at the mapping stack, which is defined using the exponential rule. I don't want to get into the definition. So the mapping stack is again pre-topological. No, no, all maps.
Can I just go back to the previous course for a second? The second light generalized cohomology theory. So yesterday in Jacob's talk, he talked about the two types of
right. So you get the one corresponding to the Borel construction.
Yes.
Actually, this is pretty easy how to do those. I will explain later. So let me just draw some corollaries of this, and then I explain what first and the second facts mean. So first corollary of this is that you can define a loop stack for a stack. So you can define path to stack of a topological stack, and so on. So these are all, again, topological stacks, pre-topological stacks. Okay. Now let me go back to those, to the first two claims I made up there. So the reason we can do one and two is because of the following fact. Every pre-topological stack, so X is a pre-topological stack, there exists an atlas, that means an epimorphism from a topological space X into my stack X, such that, let me call this phi, such that phi is a universal weak equivalence. What does this mean? It means if I base change this map to a topological space, it will be a weak equivalence. So for any map from a topological, this is backwards. For any map from a topological space into X, if I look at the base extension, then this is a weak equivalence. So basically what we do in order to define homotopy groups or cohomology groups is we look at this guy. So we define homotopy groups of this to be the same as those ones for this. Let me just sketch the proof. The proof is what you expect it to be. What we do is we look at a groupoid presentation for this, then we look at the corresponding simplicial space, and we look at the realization. So it's just a geometric realization of the groupoid presenting this. So this be a groupoid presentation. Groupoid presentation for X. Then you form this. Starts from X0, X1, X2. So X2 is X1 times X1 over X0. And so on. And then we take the fat realization. So it's a slightly different from the usual realization in the sense that we don't kill the degeneracies. So take once we take the fat realization, let's call that BX, it turns out that there is an X torsor over this BX, which we can call BX, once we construct this X torsor, it follows that there is a map from BX into X, and that will be the desired atlas. So and then you have to do some work to show that this is a universal weak equivalence. So this explains why we get the Borel construction in the case of a group action, because this gives you basically, in the case of a group, this gives you the Milner construction for the classifying space. Okay, just a few more words about, well, I'm running out of time, so maybe I should skip a few details here. Okay, I will just say a few words about why we care about Horowitz topological stacks. So, more here refers to the fact that the category of pre-topological stacks has a big drawback, which is that pushouts are very badly behaved in that category. For example, if you take a usual pushout of topological spaces, it will no longer be a pushout in the category of pre-topological stacks. Even the simplest pushout, let's take two intervals and glue them together at the endpoint. This will not be a pushout in the category of topological pre-topological stacks. So in other words, we cannot compose loops. So we cannot talk about fundamental groups in the usual sense. I mean, of course, we can define fundamental groups using this, but we cannot define them using the usual definition as maps from the circle into stack. Once we make this Horowitz assumption, then everything becomes much better behaved. So the main idea here is that pushouts, not all pushouts, but certain pushouts are well behaved. So in particular, we can compose homotopies. So if you have two paths, you can compose them. Or in general, if you have two homotopies between maps, you can compose them to a new homotopy. So homotopies are well behaved. Certain gluing constructions are well behaved. And just a final remark, which is not relevant to our discussion, is that the definition of pi n in terms of homotopy classes of maps from the sphere into X makes sense. So in other words, we have an alternative definition for homotopy groups in the classical way, and this turns out to coincide with the definition coming from this approach. So that's why we eventually want to work with these kinds of topological stacks. Okay, so that's the end of part two. If you don't have any more questions, I move on to part three. So I will just say a few words about string topology, like what is it that we want to do with the homology of a loop space. So the idea is this. So the idea So I think this goes back to Chast Sullivan, but the approach that we are using in this paper is the one of Cohen, Jones, Godin. So the idea is this. So if you look at the homology of the loops of the loop space of an oriented manifold, then there is a product on the homology of the free loop space. So this is the free loop space. Which combines the Pontryagin product. I don't know how to spell Pontryagin. On the homology of the base loop space and the intersection product on the homology of M. Let me make a remark here that there is actually a lot more structure going on. So there's this Batalin-Wilkowiecki, whatever that means, the structure on that. So. I don't know how to spell Wilkowiecki. So there's a Batalin-Wilkowiecki structure. And also I think there is a non-co-unital Frobenius structure, whatever that means. I don't want to get into those, I just want to give you the main idea of how this product comes about. So let me draw you a picture. So let's take two cycles in the homology of the free loop space and try to intersect them. So how does a cycle look like? It looks like a cycle in the manifold. So imagine the blackboard is M. So the cycle in LM looks like a cycle in M together with a loop at every point in the cycle. Now, if I take another cycle in LM, that can also be realized in this form. And I can perturb it a little bit so that the underlying cycle will meet this one transversely. So assume this is the next one. I don't know what happened. Okay. No? It's a Moritz Escher painting. Okay, so this other guy also comes with a bunch of loops. Like this. So in particular, if I look at the intersection, I have two types of loops, the purple loops and the orange loops. So what I can do, I have a green. So what I can do is I can look at the intersection cycle equipped with the composition of these two loops. So now I have this cycle here, and at every point I have a green loop attached to that cycle. I'm going backwards for some reason. Okay, so that's the Chas-Sullivan intersection product. If I want to make this precise, I should look at the following diagram. So I look at the map from M into M cross M. This is just a diagonal. Then I look at the evaluation map from the loop space times loop space into M. So I'm evaluating a circle at the base point. If I take the Cartesian product of this, what I get is the mapping space from the figure 8 into M. So let me call this P. And then I have a map from this guy into the loop space. So the way it works is if I have something like this, then I can compose them to get a loop inside M. So this is just a composition map. Okay, now if I look at the homology, what happens with the homology in the top row? I will get a map from the homology of LM tensor, the homology of LM. This goes into the homology of this guy using the Giesing map, because see, the homology is going backwards. So I have to use the Giesing map. So I use the Giesing map for this map. I end up in here. And then I use the usual push forward usual functoriality of H star to land in LM. And here I guess I missed some indices. So this should be star minus N. This is also star minus N, where N is the dimension of M. So the key point here is that this Giesing map exists. And that's a non-trivial fact. The reason it exists, at least if you want to hand wave, as those guys all did, is, see here, this is a map between infinite dimensional spaces. So it's not a priori clear that the Giesing map should exist. But the point is, this map is a map between manifolds, so it has a nice normal bundle, okay? And this is some sort of a submersion. So if I pull this back up here, the map I obtain still has a nice normal bundle. So it has a finite dimensional normal bundle. So I can use Giesing map, because all I care about is the normal bundle of the map and not just the objects themselves. So for that reason, the Giesing map still makes sense. And once you go from here to here is easy. So this is the Chass-Sullivan product. Let me make a remark here that this has been generalized to orbifolds of the form M divided by finite group, G finite, by Lupercio Uribe and Shikotenkatel. Okay, now we come to the last part of the talk. So in the last part of the talk, what I want to do is I want to show that once you have a stack that is nice enough, you can do the same thing with the stack. And that way you obtain this product. In fact, you obtain this whole Batalin-Wilkowski structure on the homology of the loop stack. And the main technical input is those Fulton-McPherson bivariant theories. So I will use them to define the Giesing maps. Okay. So let me state the theorem. No. I'm going. Yeah, it's completely formal. So once you set up a bivariant theory, everything is formal.
But the category that the bivariant theory is on is quite different from the one that you told us about.
Right. So it will be a certain category of some nice topological stacks. So you need to put some smallness condition on the stacks, like there is a paracompact at last, blah, blah. So. Actually, I don't know. We don't need that for the loop space. No. So it's kind of. Yeah, it's kind of. Actually, no. I'm sorry. Right. I need that. Okay. So what I'm going to say is that, in fact, I'm going to work with a big category of topological spaces, and it turns out that there is no bivariant theory on that category in the sense I defined. There should be a you have to make a modification in the definition. That's what I call generalized bivariant theories, in which products are not always defined. So we have partially defined products. So there is some technical issues there. And then you have to work hard to show that you have enough products to construct the Giesen maps. So that was a technical issue I wanted to wave my hands over, but you caught me. So let me state the theorem. Okay, so the theorem so let X be a Hurwitz topological stack . Okay, there is some finiteness condition on X that I don't want to write down. But other than that technical assumption, we have some more conceptual assumptions that we have to make on X. So the conceptual assumptions is that the diagonal map has the following properties. It's proper. I haven't defined what a proper map between topological stacks mean, but you can try to imagine what it should. And then I also require it's oriented and normally non-singular. So oriented, normally non-singular is something I cannot really give a I sort of could, but probably I won't. So basically what this means is that this map has a nice normal bundle, and the normal bundle is oriented. But of course, in this setting, you cannot really talk about normal bundles, so you have to follow what Fulton and McPherson do. So the idea would be that you want to find a diagram like this. So this is delta, such that F is a vector bundle over X, E is a vector bundle over X times X. This is an open embedding. And if I go by the zero section and then compose with the open embedding and then go back, if I do that, I find a closed embedding from X into E. So this is the definition of normally non-singular. If both these guys can be chosen to be oriented, then it's called oriented normally non-singular. If you don't understand what this means, the idea is that this map has a normal bundle. Okay? So once this is satisfied and some technical conditions here, then we have a string topology. We have a string operations on the homology of the loop stack. So this loop stack doesn't have to be Hurwitz anymore. But still, we can talk about the homology, because homology makes sense for any pre-topological stack. So let me just give you a couple of examples where that condition is satisfied, and if I have time, I will sketch the idea of the proof. So the first example is that every differentiable orbifold and in fact anytime you have a compact Lie group acting on a manifold such that the action is orientation. Okay, this is oriented. This is orientation preserving plus, again, there is this unfortunate condition I have to put here. The action has finite orbit type. Then those conditions are satisfied for the quotient stack. Finite orbit type means that if you look at the stabilizer groups of the action, they fall into finitely many conjugacy classes. So, for example, if M has the following property, if all its singular homologies are finitely generated for every n, then it's finite. It has any compact Lie group action on M will have finite orbit type. So in particular, we get an equivariant version of Chasse-Sullivan's theory for compact Lie groups acting on this kinds of manifolds. I don't have much time left, so let me just give you a quick sketch of what goes into the proof.
Is it a Forel type equivariant series, or is it not?
That's a good question. I'm not sure if I understood what your question is, but. one question that I was asking myself, I should think about that, is maybe it's related to your question. I'll try to make my question. So what if I look at the homology of the Borel construction associated to this, and what is the string topology of BG? That term, I think Greg knows the answer to that question. Yeah, he did the computations in the BG case. I don't know the answer. I should have looked at it. But.
Yeah.